not exactly the images that first come to a lot of our minds when we think of community, but that's exactly what we're going to deal in today, and connect the dots on that. Would you please pray with me? God, first of all, we do thank you that you are a God of community. You've not designed us to do life by ourselves. But God, you also know just whenever it involves imperfect people that there is such potential for ditches that we can fall into, for rubbing against each other in harsh ways. So God, we ask that you would give us a little bit clearer insight on this thing called conflict and how that plays into who you want us to be, and that you would bring us that truth from your words in the Bible today. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we are for these next 4 weeks taking a look at this thing called community, and I think it's a rather strange thing, actually, community, because it's a word that all of us know, but yet is so nebulous for most of us, has so many different definitions of what we actually think that it is or it should be. And I think part of that is because community has become this buzzword that seemed to be promised to us at every turn. We cannot turn around without somebody either overtly or subtly promising us community, whether it's a real estate agent who's showing us, you know, some places that we can live, whether it's a beer commercial, or it's a church. Everybody seems to be in some form promising us this thing called community. But in the same breath, we so often, almost always, are promised community, but so rarely, if ever, do we ever really experience it. And so we have this gap. We have this gap in between the promise and the experience that's a real disconnect for us. Everywhere we go, whether it's a cup of coffee or whatever, it seems to me the community is a subtle part of the promise. But yet we have this feeling, we think that something's been taken from us and we're not sure what it is. And this thing called real friendships and real neighbors, and what exactly does that look like? Because I don't feel like I get to taste it very often, if at all. And today, we're going to start digging into that. I mean, conflict may seem like a strange place to start a discussion on community and what it means. And I think that's strange for most of us, because most of us somehow tend to define community as a place that I go to get away from conflict. You know, it's a community is a place where I find people who we so agree with each other on so many things, we're so like each other that we never have disagreements and we never have conflict. And so community is this kind of conflict-free zone. It's this oasis that I go to get away from conflict. I've noticed around town, anybody seen these cicada-free zones? You know, that, you know, you get, whether it's restaurants or it's bars, you know, have to sign up, you know, kind of cicada-free zone. You can go there to kind of get away from it. And has anybody also heard Brian Tome whining about how the cicada invasion is not living up to his expectations? Yeah, you know, I don't know about him. I picked them out of my hair, picked them out of my... I can only imagine his expectations are somehow based on the book of Exodus or something. You know, it's what is not quite living up to, you know, what he thought it would be. But they have these little signs, this cicada-free zone you can go to. I think that's how a lot of us define community. Community is a conflict-free zone that I can go to. And that is a significant problem, and I think that is one of the key barriers why most of us never really experience the intimacy of real friendships and real community. Because whenever psychologists or anybody else takes a look at groups, great groups in life, groups where not only has there been significant individual growth and change and even healing in the lives of individual people, but also groups that the combination of their individual growth has resulted in those groups accomplishing significant things for mankind, whether it be in the area of arts, it be in science, it be in business, it be in academia, wherever. And they look at those, and you know what they find across the board? We tend to think that these great groups, the litmus test for them must be the absence of conflict. And it's not what they find. As a matter of fact, what they find is that the litmus test for these healthy groups is actually the presence of conflict, if dealt with in a healthy way. That the litmus test is actually the presence of conflict, you know, if it's dealt with in a healthy way. And so in varying degrees, we find this as a barrier in our life of not being able to experience this thing that we really want called community. And I know for me, it's often been a definition of community I've carried around that's kept me from kind of going to real places. You know, when I go to a wedding, I often find it interesting that there's a scripture that is very often used at weddings. I'd say about half the weddings I'm at, it's used. And it can be appropriate for weddings, certainly. It's called the love chapter. It's from 1 Corinthians in the Bible, 1 Corinthians 13. Most of you have probably been to a wedding where you've seen this shared, and totally appropriate for sharing at weddings. But I think the verbiage is interesting. We kind of can read right past it and not really think about it. And Paul is saying there, he says, love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It's not proud. It's not rude. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. Keeps no record of wrongs. Now, what's interesting, this is shared as kind of this warm, fuzzy wedding moment scripture. When you look at it, there's very little that's warm, fuzzy about it. As a matter of fact, most of the things he's calling us to are things that you exclusively do when you're ticked off at somebody. You know, when you take a look, it's not easily angered. Keeps no record of wrongs. Is patient. Part of the definition of love that the Apostle Paul has given us is that it involves conflict and involves the careful way we work through it. Patience, not being easily angered, keeping no record of wrongs. And so we find that conflict, by definition, is part of community. And I know for me, I just want to kind of give a little caveat here. I do not stand up here this morning as this poster boy of effective conflict management. You know, it's, as a matter of fact, I would say it's probably one of the probably the three worst things I do in my life. And I'm not prepared to tell you the other two, but that one right there, one of the three worst. I just do not do it well. And I can look at the track record of my life and relationships that I have bruised and people that I've wounded because I go to one of a couple extremes on conflict and not deal with it another way. But over the past about 10 or 15 years, I found myself slowly in very awkward ways growing in how I do this thing that I'm very naturally poor at. And it's been growth based on the counsel that God gives us in the Bible of the way we're designed and how we're to interact with each other. And so what I want to share this morning is kind of three main problems I have to work through when it comes to how I approach conflict. And the first one I've been thinking of, because Nancy and I have been having our house painted. And one of the wild things I found when we were painting our house is that the colors that we picked out in the paint store, the little sample, it's not quite the color that I'm getting on my house. I try to figure out, well, what's the deal with this? This is the color. I wanted tan. That looks like yellow. You know, what's the deal? And I've realized that the color of the paint is only one variable in this equation. The color of the paint is only one variable in what I see on my house. What I see on my house is based on the color of the paint that I choose. It's based on the materials that my house is made out of. It is based on the shade of the primer that went on my house first. And it's even based on the angle that the sun is hitting that side of my house during a certain time of the day. Color of paint is just kind of one variable in that. And, you know, not only people that paint houses, but artists that use paint have realized this as well. If you take a look at the walls around you, even kind of up here, if you came in a little early, you notice on these side walls, there's these paintings here. These are artists that are within the community here at Crossroads who we asked them to do some works for us that would represent how they think of community. And that's these paintings that you see on the wall when you came in and then kind of up here. Well, artists that work in paint have also realized, this is the fact as well, that what you see is not just a representation of the paint that is on the surface. As a matter of fact, particularly with older paintings, sometimes this can really come into light, because what happens is that if that older painting was done on a canvas that something else had been painted on it before, or there were other strokes or other versions, earlier versions of that painting put on there before, over time those colors that are beneath the surface can tend to seep through. And they can, even if you can't see them or identify them, they are affecting the color and the shade of what you see on the surface. And sometimes artists actually use this proactively because they know this happens. They will purposely put paint underneath that will bleed through and change the way the top looks. It's a term called pentimento. And pentimento is when what you see on the surface is being affected by what's beneath the surface of the paint, and that over time it actually bleeds through. Well, you know, what's interesting is that God has not only created art that way, He has created people that way as well. See, one of the big misnomers I think we have when it comes to conflict is we feel that we are painting on blank canvases. You know, we feel that, you know, that any argument is entirely composed of the exact words that I chose. You know, I know within the first 5 years of my marriage, I always thought, you know, after an argument, man, if I could just get a written transcript of what went down, just a written transcript, I could point, say, look, this is exactly what I said, and here's where you need to grow. You know, it would be my thing. I just get a transcript. You know, because you think that, oh, the argument's only made over. It's not. It's not. The fact is, there is so much more on people's canvases. We are not painting on blank canvases with our words. We are all painting on dirty canvases. So, you know, for instance, you have an argument over a project with somebody at work. You know, you need to realize that the discussion you're having with them is not just about that project they're having right now. What's also influencing that discussion is the fact that 2 weeks ago, rumors started going around that there were going to be more layoffs. You know, is the fact that they had a fight with their wife before they left this morning, and the fact that you look just like their college roommate who stole their Dark Side of the Moon CD in 1989. You know, all that is coming into play. We are not there. You're painting on dirty canvases, you know, and you think about that and you're like, wow, yeah, people are screwed up, aren't they? You know? Well, you know, here's the thing. It's not just them. It's not just them. We're the same way. We are all dirty canvases. As a matter of fact, all we are is one dirty canvas painting on another. And we need to realize that when it comes to disagreements and it comes to tough conversations that we have, it's more than just the words. We're one dirty canvas painting on another. We have referred to this book before here at Crossroads. As a matter of fact, we had a seminar that's based a lot on the content of this book. There's this group called the Harvard Negotiation Project, and they took a look at how people have disagreements and how you can work through differences in a way that actually results in learning and growth. And they published a book based on that called Difficult Conversations. And one of the interesting things that they found in here is they said that difficult conversations are actually three conversations happening concurrently. In any difficult conversation we have, there are three conversations going on at the same time. The first one is what they'd call the what happened conversation, actually about the facts of what happened there, you know, just going over facts. The second one is the feelings conversation, and that's more the emotions that may or may not be related to the facts that are happening in that conversation at the third time. But then there's a third conversation, really deep beneath the surface, but affecting that whole conversation. There's the identity conversation, where in any difficult conversation we have, at some form, we feel the question that's being posed in that conversation is, am I a competent person? Or the question that's being posed is, am I a good person? And all three of those conversations are going on at the same time. And if you find that you're somebody that approaches difficult conversations in a very tough way, or you're not seeing the results that you'd like to, you know, this fall we're going to be offering that seminar again, talking about how we can pursue difficult conversations in ways that become learning conversations for all of us. About a month ago, Molly Cunningham and Brian and I, we did this video in here. We did this takeoff on American Chopper. Has anybody seen American Chopper on TV? Yeah, some of us. For those of us that haven't, American Chopper is a reality show on the Discovery Channel that is follows the work life of this family-owned business out on the East Coast, and they customize motorcycles. They build these really expensive customized choppers. What's interesting is the show is only partially about the actual product that they build and the really cool motorcycles they build. The underlying current of the whole show is the tension in the relationship between the father, Paul Sr., and his, who's the owner of the company, and his son, Paul Jr., who's kind of the creative engine that really drives the great ideas that the company gets. And it's about how different they are, about how their dirty canvases rub up against each other. And again in these episodes, we see that the end result that they have has to go through them rubbing up against each other in this way. So I want to take a look at a clip here. I think this is just a classic picture of what happens when they're working on a project.
Hey. Yeah, what's up?
I'm sitting here waiting
for you, like, and so is everybody else. You know what I mean? Don't even bother coming in.
Here it is, just a few days before the Javits Center, and Paulie's late. Spent half the morning trying to get him on a cell phone, but the cell phone doesn't work. It's like Paulie could care less about deadlines.
Vinny, what's got to be done? Where do you want to start on this bike?
But they're important to me, especially this one. Because this bike is supposed to be our centerpiece at the Javits Center, and we've never been there before, and we really want to blow people away with this bike.
Neither. You know what? That's bull. That's bull. Then you know what? Stay home. Go home. You know what I mean? You got like 10 people here waiting. You know what I mean? On you. On the king. You know what? Suck it up a little bit. Your phone hasn't worked in 3 months.
It doesn't ring out loud. It works just fine.
Oh, it doesn't ring out loud. Hey, whoop. Man, that's just wonderful. You know what? I don't really care. I'm shutting it off. Bottom line, it's shut off. Either you fix the phone today or it gets shut off. I already told the secretary.
My phone works fine. It just doesn't ring.
Did you hear what I said?
No, I don't.
You know what? I don't really care. Sick of it.
I think my favorite part of that is my phone rings, just not out loud. Slacker, man. And that's my reaction that I have when I watch it. It's interesting when my wife and I will catch an episode of that and we'll see something like that happen. You know, what I'll say is man, Paul Jr., I mean, he's standing up all those people, showing them he doesn't really care about their time, totally disrespecting them. That is just such bad behavior. What a jerk. You know, and then my wife's response, she sees that, and she says, man, Paul Sr., how can he talk to somebody like that, especially in front of other people? How can he do that to his own son? Man, Paul Sr., what a jerk. And I find is that we both are so ready to offer grace to different people. And I'm so much more like Paul Sr. in that I'm, you know, kind of structured, you know, and very organized. And also, I can tend to not choose my words very carefully when I'm having conflict with someone. Where my wife is much more like Paul Jr. She's more free-flowing. She's more kind of mellow about it. And so I can so much more easily offer grace to Paul Sr. And Nancy can do the same for Paul Jr. And that is the real problem of pentimento when it comes to human lives. It's the problem of different dirt. The problem of different dirt. That we can find it not so big of a challenge to offer grace to people who have the same kind of dirt that we do. For people that have the same kind of challenges, the same kind of problems. But when it comes to somebody who's significantly different than us, then we have a much greater chance of going straight to judging them. Or going, you know, and not being able to find a way to offer them grace. And this is just something that's just built into the advice that God gives us in the Bible. I mean, a lot of people think that, you know, like the Bible was about these communities, you know, that were all perfect, you know, and really nice. When you look at the New Testament of the Bible and the record of the early church, I mean, it was just one conflict after another. And you take a look in the book of Ephesians, which was a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to the new church at Ephesus, and take a look at what he says in Ephesians 4, too. He tells them, hey, be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. There's this verbiage there of bearing with. The idea that our first reaction when it comes to conflict needs to be to cut other people some grace. To bear with them, to realize we're all dirty canvases painting on each other, and the real challenge is the problem of different dirt. And so the first step to healthy conflict management is that some of us often need to just lighten up. We need to lighten up. And sometimes I think every time the first question we need to ask ourselves if we're feeling angry about something, the first question we need to ask ourselves is a conversation that we need to have not with the other person, but it's a conversation that we need to have with God. You know, and I found the question I have to ask myself if I'm feeling angry is or frustrated with something or mad, whatever, is what is hurt? What has been hurt? Because at the basis of all of that is something that I feel has been hurt, something that I feel has been taken from me. And I have to do some real gut check questions, say, what is hurt? And you know what? It's embarrassing to say at least half the time, the answer to that question that I get is pride. It's basically in one form or the other, my ego has been dented by this. And so what I often find when it comes to conflict, and about half the time when I come to the answer to that question, is that it's pride. The conversation I need to have is not with the other person. Although they may have some issues, the conversation I need to have with God is with God. And say, God, what is it about me that my image of myself and who I am is so easily damaged by something that somebody else said? And so about half the time, when I'm feeling a source of conflict, it doesn't even result in a conflict with the other person because there's a much greater thing that God's wanting to deal in with me about. And so, like, for instance, one thing, you know, if you read the Bible much, you see that there's this thing that we are called to. We are called to called servanthood. And it's this life that Jesus modeled for us, which is about serving other people. And, you know, I get that on a certain level. And I know that as a pastor, that is something particularly I'm responsible for before God as far as modeling for other people. So I'm called to serve. And so I try to live my life in a way that I'm serving and helping other people. And I find, you know, a lot of the time I'm able to do that within a lot of contexts. You know, the one context that I find it most difficult, almost impossible to serve other people, it's when I go somewhere and I'm treated like a servant. Ooh, hold on a second here. Let's just get this straight. First we establish my nobility and then I serve, okay? That's the sequence here, and it's very important we get that sequence right, you know? So it's kind of a strategic servanthood, you know, I've kind of worked out in my life. I found that often it's that kind of stuff that's the core of the conflict that I'm feeling. And so the first conversation I have is actually I need to have a conversation with God. Say, God, show me this and help me change. Because I found as I've been honest and looked around, that the role of imperfection in this whole thing is something that God has given us. You know, that I look around me and I see imperfect people. I mean, I see that my coworkers are imperfect. I see my family members are imperfect. I see that my friends are imperfect. And you know what? I see that I am what? No, surrounded by imperfect people. I am surrounded. You would not believe the imperfect people God has strategically placed in my life. You know, and I am a growth engine. You know, it's just, I don't know what kind of plan he has for me, but no, that we're all imperfect. We are all dirty canvases painting on each other. And the underlying problem is different dirt. But we overcome that. First of all, we learn to lighten up, and we take that to God first. Because at the end of the day, I can just promise you this for the rest of your life. Absolute ironclad guarantee. God will continually put you in imperfect places with imperfect people for your growth. Imperfection and conflict is actually a laboratory for growth within community. Now, I'm not saying that it's easy. As a matter of fact, most of us have a knee-jerk reaction to how we pursue conflict. And most of us have these kind of knee-jerk in-runs that we do. We all have these customized in-runs, which is kind of our favorite mode for doing an end-run around really going through healthy conflict. For a lot of people, it looks in, you know, a lot of different ways. I know growing up, I had a friend in grade school named Henry Ruggles. And Henry just absolutely hated any kind of tension or any kind of disagreement, just really stressed him out. People were having conflict of any way. And so, you know, in fourth grade in particular, you know, you can really see it coming out. Maybe like in fourth grade in Mrs. Taggart's class, something would get broken in the classroom or something would get stolen, you know, and no one would fess up to it. So, you know, Mrs. Taggart, you know, would gather everybody together, you know, and try to get to the bottom of it. And you could just see Henry, you know, in the back of the room. Even if it had nothing to do with it, it's just shaking, you know, just kind of hates conflict. And if it was a particularly serious issue, let's say that somebody stole the Welcome to Womanhood fourth grade girls film strip, you know, or, you know, something like that. It's a hypothetical situation. I am neither confirming nor denying any involvement in this. We all remember the film strip, right? Your body is beautiful and growing. Bing! You know, boys are evil. Stay away. Bing! Well, if that had happened, if it was a really serious offense like that, should bring in the principal, Mr. Jean. Now, I need to say, I have a huge deal of respect for school administrators and teachers. We have a lot of them here. And there's a lot of principals and teachers. They could be doing a lot of other things with their life that are much easier. But because they love kids, they're doing what they're doing. So I have a ton of respect for school principals. The one that I grew up with, however, was an idiot. Okay? Absolute idiot. His favorite mode of breaking things up in school was to grab you by your earlobe and twist it until I saw many kids lifted down the hallway on one foot while he's, you know, carrying the air. Well, what Mr. Jean would come in this kind of situation is, he would come in the classroom and then they would do the whole interrogation technique in the whole class. Okay, until somebody fesses up to this, everyone's going to be punished. You know, so until somebody says, what happened here, no one gets to go to recess. You know, that whole interrogation technique, which, you know what, even in fourth grade, we knew the value of solidarity to keep the man off our back, you know, so nobody would break. You'd see Henry in the back room kind of sweating, though, you know, he was, you know, getting ready to break, but, you know, they, you know, no one's, and then, and sure enough, and I totally promise, totally true, this happened numerous times in fourth grade. Henry would crack, and he would stand up, and he would say, Mrs. Taggart, I didn't do it, but I'll say I did it if you'll let everybody else go to recess. Now, even in fourth grade, we realized something's not right with Henry, you know. There's some deep stuff going on there, you know. That is not, man, weird. So, you know, afterwards, you know, like the next day on the playground, we'd take Henry aside and say, Henry, you know, that ain't right. You know, don't, if you weren't involved, you know, don't stand up and say, you know, I didn't do it, but I'll say I did it so everybody can else go to recess, you know. Just say you did it. Just say you did it. And all of you, that's the way that this thing works. But Henry, he couldn't stand, you know, conflict. So I can only pray that he's found a good therapist by now, you know, it's kind of working through the things. We all, that was his end run to kind of diffuse conflict. We all have our favorite kind of customized end runs we like to do that go around going through the tunnel of healthy conflict. And you know what? I think the favorite one among adults, the favorite adult end run, you know, looks something like this. I have an issue with you. I have an issue with you. I'm ticked off. Maybe you came late to me. You know, whatever it is. So I go and I tell you. Or I go and I tell you, or you, or you, or anybody and everybody except you. I think that's our favorite adult end run around healthy conflict. It is so predominant that psychologists have a term for it. It's called triangulation. Triangulation. It's where instead of going to the person we have an issue with, we go to all these other people instead. And it's one of the most dysfunctional ways that conflict can really undermine the life of a community. I'm going to take a look at how this plays out. Okay, let's go back to, you know, kind of the case study of American Chopper. So let's say in this instance that Paul Sr. has an issue with Paul Jr. because Paul Jr., you know, showing up late for work again and you know, really putting the project behind, showing disrespect to others. But instead of going to Paul Jr., even in a very dysfunctional way, instead of going to him, he goes to Mikey. You know, he goes to, you know, his other son works off. He goes and tells Mikey, you know, what a screw-up Paul Jr. is. That's triangulation, and that's the way it plays out. And you know what? There's a special flavor of triangulation, a special twist that happens within churches, and it's sometimes called prayer requests. You know, prayer requests. Can you believe what she did? You need to pray for her. She's not doing well. It's triangulation nonetheless. And that is another deep-seated problem that we have with conflict that I have to wrestle with, is the problem of triangulation. Is that for a lot of us, it's our knee-jerk response. And what's interesting, our Creator knows us so well. He had this off at the pass years ago. This problem of triangulation is directly confronted in the Bible. In the book of Matthew, which is one of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four books in the Bible that people call the Gospels. It's the collected historical account of Jesus' life on earth. Take a look in the book of Matthew in 18, what Jesus tells us to do, his own words. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you've won your brother over. But if he will not listen, take one or two others along, so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And then it goes on. It goes on to say, if that doesn't work out, then you together, all of you, you go to somebody in authority and you try to work it out, you know, within your community. It goes on to lay that out. But look where it starts. It says every single time, there's no exception. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault. Now, there may be times where it's just not healthy. If somebody is violent, you know, or something, there may be some professional intervention that's needed. But generally, if your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you've won your brother over. And so what Jesus is saying there is that we counter the problem, this problem of triangulation, by going to the source. First, we lighten up, but then if we do need to pursue conflict, we go to the source. So how it would play out for Paul Sr. is Paul Sr. would go to Paul Jr. Now, maybe he needs to take a moment to kind of cool off so that it can be in somewhat of a healthy conversation. But he goes to Paul Jr. and he says, hey, you know what? When you show up late and you don't call like that, you waste all these other people's time. You endanger the timing on this project we need to get finished. And most of all, you show disrespect to everybody else in here. We have a real hard time creating a team environment when you do that kind of thing. And when Paul Sr. does that, it does a couple things. One is it gives Paul Sr. a growth opportunity to learn how to have conversations about things he doesn't like in a way that's not destructive. It doesn't, see, triangulation robs everybody of a growth opportunity. So Paul Sr. gets that growth opportunity. Mikey is totally left out of the equation, which he should be. He shouldn't be part of this deal. And in the end, what happens is Paul Jr. gets his slacker act together and he shows up on work like any mature adult should, right? You know, so, you know, end result, everything, you know, kind of works out. We need to learn to go to the source. And I think that's the case a lot of times of what our knee-jerk is. But we all have kind of customized versions of these end runs. What I'd like you to do is to take just a couple seconds here and just think about what is your default mode? What's your end run of choice when it comes to dealing with conflict that you know, even if it doesn't cause problems in the short term, in the long run, it's not a healthy choice. Just think about that for a few seconds. And if you want, just write it down in the margin of your notes there. What is your default mode that is an unhealthy end run around conflict? Now, you know, I will say that these first two, they're not things I do perfectly, but these first two aren't really the problem for me. I can do a pretty good job of, you know, lightening up and going to the source. It's in this third one that I have found the roots of most of the pain and the bruises that I've caused in my history, in my relationships, in my friendships, and in my family. It's what I would call the problem of pathological truth. You know, we've all heard of pathological liars, you know, people who just cannot tell the truth. You know, they just, whether it's a personality disorder or whatever, they just lie continually. Well, there is also a thing as a pathological truth teller. And a pathological truth teller is somebody that just feels the need to blurt out their version of truth, just to kind of blast it out without any concern of how that information is delivered. You know, so it, you know, looks like, you know, you're late. You know, it's your second time. Boy, your mom sure did a number on you. And it just kind of blasts it out. And what do they do? What do we do? I'm a card-carrying member of that group trying to grow through it. What do we call that? Just telling the truth. Hey, just telling the truth. I read a book a few years ago. I thought it was really interesting on this topic. It's by a physician by the name of Dr. Diane Comp. And the book's called Anatomy of a Lie. And what she talked about in there is the struggle she has as a physician of how she delivers devastating news to patients, particularly young patients that have terminal illness. And how she does that, how she keeps... does that in as healthy a way as possible and doesn't lie to them. How can she do that without lying but also be sensitive to them in that situation? So how can she do that in the most productive way? And she came to call what she's come to as a merciful version of the truth. That she had to find a way to deliver a merciful version of the truth to these patients. Now, we hear that, and you know, I want you to know, that is not finding a way just to tell the person exactly what they want to hear. This is not finding a way just to present to the person this kind of exact, carefully crafted image, you know, and kind of that's it. That's called dating, and we'll deal with that in a whole other, you know, kind of venue. No, what a merciful version of the truth is we find a way to deliver truth to people in a way that's not destructive, but also not reductionary, and is also not demeaning. That there is a way, there is a possibility for us to deliver merciful versions of the truth to each other. And again, the Bible dealt with this and laid this out. Paul, in a letter that he's writing to the new church at Ephesus in Ephesians, he talks about this term, speaking the truth in love. He said, instead of all these other default mechanisms that we have, instead of all these other unhealthy end runs, instead, we can speak the truth in love to each other. And you notice there's two real key words there, truth and love, that they can both exist together. That there's this tension that we are called to live in community. There's this tension where grace and truth can both breathe at the same time. And this, again, this is the main challenge I find in my life. How do I put truth and love together? And my track record hasn't always been great on this, and particularly in the early years of my marriage. I delivered some things, some was truth, some was just what I perceived as truth, to my wife in a very graceless way. And I caused some real damage there. And, you know, we've worked through that. But, you know, there are still some ramifications long term on that that we're still growing through. And I know our marriage is healthier than ever. But still, there are some things in those early years that I did. It was just graceless truth. Well, now after, 12 years of marriage, I found in varying degrees ways in very awkward attempts that I can deliver graceful truth to her. And we can find effective ways, you know, to kind of work through this. And I had one of those situations about 3 weeks ago. Nancy and I were getting ready to go somewhere with our youngest, Grace, who's 5. And Grace did something that was just kind of rebelling against her mom. And she did something specific that Nancy and I talked about before. And we said, you know what? In this kind of situation, whenever she does that, we have got to get a handle on this. So we're going to nip this in the bud. This is the immediate intervention we're going to do when this kind of thing happens. And we felt that it was pretty important to do that. Well, Grace did this. Nancy took her back inside the house, and she didn't do that. She did something else with Grace. And I was seething. I was seething because I was like, man, this is the exact kind of thing that if replicated is going to be an issue for our daughter. She has these incredible, wonderful qualities about her, but we've got to learn to channel it in the right direction. This is the exact kind. Now, here's how my normal knee-jerk reaction, what I would have done over these last 12 years and what I have often done, would have walked back in right where Nancy and Grace were standing. I would have said, look, this is the exact kind of thing I was talking about, you know, a couple of weeks ago. This is the exact kind of thing. We have got to nip this in the bud. This is unacceptable. She cannot be doing this. We need to change this. We need to have a zero tolerance policy right now. And I would have taken Grace away. Yeah, a lot of you ladies are looking at me right now like, boy, what a catch. You know, how can I get me one of those? You know? Yeah. Well, I do have a brother, but he is married, so, you know. You know what? This time I did it different. This time. And I think that it's because I've tried it so clumsy for so long, but I've tried to grow in it, and through God's grace and me praying about it, I was able to do this one different. What happened was, at that moment, I was seething. And I have got to get it out when it happens like that. I just feel so much better if I just deal with it immediately, you know, kind of thing. And I felt just God say, you know what? Say nothing. Let this one sit. Because Brian, take a look at the track record of when you do it the way that feels good. It doesn't end up with the result that anybody wants, and you never get to talk about the issue that's really at hand anyway. Just let this one sit. So all day long, I just seethed. I mean, I just could feel it beneath my skin. Oh, I want to deal with this. Oh, and several times during the day, I would pray, and I'd say, God, help me figure out how to deal with this, because I cannot let this go, but I want to deal in the right way, not the way I have in the past. So all day long, I kind of had that going on. And that night, we put the kids to bed. Nancy and I came downstairs, and I felt like, you know, now's the time, you know, that this could be, I think I'm in a healthy place, we can talk about this. So we sat down, and I said, Nance, I want to tell you, man, what I saw today with Grace, that's the exact kind of thing we were talking about a while back. And I thought we had agreed that this is the way we're going to deal with that for her own good. We've got to be painfully consistent on this thing, and you didn't do that. And I think we need to do it different from now on every time. And you know what she said? You're right. What do I say now? You know, I've got the script. I've got the whole script ready, and what? I just throw it away? You know? You know why I think she reacted that way? Because I think for once, in as awkward as the way as I did, as awkward way, I delivered graceful truth. We've got to find a way to practice graceful truth. And you know why I think the challenge for most of it is? By the time we get to be kind of developing adults, we have primarily been in one of two environments, and we've bounced between these two environments. One is a place where we have received truth. And someone has told us, hey, look, this is what's wrong. This is what you're doing wrong. This is what's dysfunctional about you. You need to change that. And they did it in a way that was completely graceless truth. And it did no good to us, because all we ended up with was more wounds and more bruises and more problems than we had before. Or we've alternated between that and situations where we've just received love. And people have just told us, you know, by their definition of love, you know, you're okay. Never mind the bodies that are strewn in your past. You're okay. You don't need to change. Everything's fine. And have never challenged us that there's anything in us that we need to change. And it is loveless truth. Or it is truthless love. And so we find ourselves bouncing into these two places, getting truth or getting love, but not getting them at the same time. When there's this place, there's this sweet spot that exists, and it's within God's definition of community, that we become for others and they become for us, this synthesis of truth and love together. Just this right blend of truth and love together. And you know what happens out of that? And it's pretty rare, but what happens out of that is this even rarer thing called growth. You know, everybody wonders, how do people change? How do people grow? How do people heal? What happens when we get in places where we get truth and love together? I love the image that the Bible gives us of what can happen in these kind of things. In that Old Testament collection of wisdom called Proverbs, Proverbs 15, says that the tongue that brings healing is a tree of life. The tongue that brings healing is a tree of life. That our tongues can actually become sources of healing for people. And just as effective as a surgeon's scalpel, they can bring healing to the lives of people around us. But just like a scalpel, if used carelessly, they can cause huge damage. But the result of that can be a tree of life. And that's the life that exists within community. When I was growing up, my parents would often take me to this one museum. And in the museum, when we first came in, there was this big tree trunk of this, I don't know, this big oak that had been toppled in a storm or something. And it had been cut off, so it was just the whole base of the tree trunk there. And you could look down at it, you know, look kind of like that, and you could see kind of all the rings of the tree in there. And, you know, one of the first things you learn when you see, like, the rings of trees is that you can find out how old that tree is by counting the number of rings, that each year represents a year of growth in that tree, so you can find out how old the tree is. But by going there several times, I ended up finding it's a little bit more of a nuance within there, is that as you look closer at that, each of the rings are not equal. That there are some rings that are dark, there's some rings that are really faint, you can hardly see them, there's some rings that are really bold and thick, and others of them are really thin. And what that represents is from that life, that year and that life of that tree, what did it get? Did it get too much sun, too much rain, not enough sun? Or the years where it's a really thick, vibrant ring is a year where that tree received just the right amount of water, just the right amount of heat, just the right amount of nutrients. And what ended up happening in that year was growth like no other. You know, I don't know about you, but where I want to get to is that at the end of my life, or even generations from now, someone can slice open my family tree, and my family consisting not just of those I'm related to, but also my friends around me, those of us here at Crossroads that are together, somebody can slice open that family tree, and they can point to one of those rings and say, you know what? That's where Joe talked to Greg about that habit he has that was really an addiction, and what happened out of that was growth. Man, that's where Ann talked to Mom about her anger and how that's affecting the kids. Man, right there, that's where two of my friends got together with me and talked to me about how my behavior that I'm trying to pull people closer to me is actually pushing people away. Right there, that spot right there, that's where truth and love happened together. That's where growth happened. And that's the healing. That's the healing and the growth that we all can have. Would you stand? I don't know if you ever think about that, of what you want those that you care about, what you want that picture to look like 20, 30 years from now. I don't want to get 20, 30 years and look around me and find that the people that I care most about, we're all still dealing with the exact same issues we were 20, 30 years ago because we have either blasted each other and caused no help, or we've totally avoided the subject, and the result has been nobody has changed, nobody has grown. I want to tell you that if you have that same longing in you that you want to see 20, 30 years from now, a lifetime from now, that kind of change that has happened, I want to tell you that is an entirely legitimate longing. That is a longing that God has put in you and He wants you to grow in and work through within the context of the community He's placed around you. And it can happen. It can happen if we learn to lighten up, we go to the source, and we practice graceful truth. Let's pray. God, every service I just have the same thought bouncing through my head at the end of this message, and that is that it is entirely within my bandwidth to talk about this and to turn around and go home in a few hours and snap at my kids in an unhealthy way. And God, we all have different flavors of this in us. Please help us see how you can take us to a different place, and a place that results in healing and growth for all of us. This weird place called conflict within community. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.